This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're reflecting on the world through the looking glass of satire. I get the scoop on what drove Howard Jacobson to sharpen his pen and write a fairy tale for adults.
In real life, a person with four words doesn't become the President of the United States.
Last year's Booker Prize winner gives us a taste of contemporary satire in the US.
The writing part is hard. I mean, it's extremely hard, but I don't know, the jokes just come.
And I'll be going postal with Terry Pratchett. That's all coming up in today's show. Howard Jacobson is probably best known for his novel The Finkler Question, which won the 2010 Man Booker Prize. In a career spanning four decades, 14 novels, and a wealth of non-fiction, his insightful satire continues to attract new fans and critical praise alike. He should get more of both with the publication of his new book in April. Pussy has been described as a ferociously funny fairy tale for adults, written in the wake of the US presidential election. Howard Jacobson, thank you very much for joining us in the RNIB studios.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me along.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more about the forthcoming novel, please.
Well, it's sort of so fresh and new. You are the first person I've really dared to talk to about it. At the beginning of last year, I finished my column at the Independent newspaper. The Independent newspaper closed in about March 2016. I'd been writing a column for it for nearly 20 years. And then when anything happened in the week, there I was able to talk about it. It was lovely not having a column for the first 3 months. And then all hell broke loose in the country and in the world. And I didn't have a column to talk about it. Brexit, the whole run-up to Brexit. Corbyn, though I just caught the beginnings of the Corbyn phenomenon. And then Trump. I could write the occasional article here and there, but that's not the same as having a column in which you build up a continuous narrative with your readers. I thought I would go mad when Trump won the election. And my wife looked at my face. She saw my wild eyes. She said, you'd better do something. I said, I haven't got a column. She said, well, then write a novel or something or other. And I said, by the time I've finished a novel, he'll be impeached. This cannot last. And I still, to this hour, every morning, I look at the newspapers and think, will he be impeached before my book comes out? Day by day, although I'm appalled by everything he says and does, I think, well, please God, let him stay in power. I put my book before the American people. My book needs to come out and he needs to be there. Then let him be impeached. So it was that. It was a book written in a few weeks, in a rush. It's not a realistic novel. It's a fantasy fairy tale novel, as you described it, because what's happening is not realistic. This isn't real. In real life, a person with four words doesn't become the President of the United States. He doesn't become the president of a company. He doesn't become anything. So the minute you put your mind to how it can be that we're in a world in which wordlessness is a positive advantage, you start thinking not only about politics, but the media. He is a phenomenon, the miracle of a no one man who's achieved everything. Only comedy, only satire can deal with this. Pussy isn't only the story of him and America, and it's not set in America. It's set in a nowhere place, as fairy stories often are. Also characters, the cast of villains as I see them from Brexit are also involved, because I don't think you can see the Trump phenomenon separately from the Brexit phenomenon. Because overarching them all, I think, is ignorance has been pitched against knowledge. That people out there are being encouraged by politicians now to trust no one who knows anything. Don't trust the experts, says Michael Gove. Don't trust knowledge at all.
The use of satire to attack fake news and post-truth politics, it suddenly made me think of Jonathan Swift, his attack on, I think, what he called false knowledge, the fact that anybody can publish any thought and not have to back it up at all with any form of evidence. You're tapping into a great tradition and bringing it fully up to date.
Well, I hope so, and certainly Swift was one of the people I was thinking of when I was writing it. And also Voltaire, it's shaped a little bit like Candide. And also Dr. Johnson, one of my favourite writers. It's shaped a little bit like Rasselas, you know, that wonderful little fable in which a prince tries to understand the meaning of life and doesn't. So those are the kind of people I'm thinking of. I have no illusions about myself. I'm embarrassed to hear myself even mentioned in the same sentence as Swift. But yes, those are the antecedents. It has been said to me, isn't there a danger in turning him into a buffoon? Doesn't that minimise the danger? And I understand the force of that question, but a buffoonery has to be mocked. But it has to be mocked in such a way that we see them as buffoons. We don't credit them with anything else other than buffoonery, while at the same time remembering the damage that a buffoon can do. A buffoon can bring the world to an end, and as long as we remember that, so that our satire produces derision, and I think that's what we need now, a stream of derision turned on the whole damn pack of them, because it's not just Trump. There are a lot of shameless people out there backing Trump up in this country as well, and I think they should be subjected to derision day and night, as long as we remember it's not a laughing matter. But just because it's not a laughing matter doesn't mean we shouldn't laugh at it.
I'm very glad to hear that you've got your ability to laugh back, though, because I for one was a little bit worried by your last couple of novels, that they were definitely on the darker side of humour. I'm thinking of both Jay and Shylock. It was as if I've heard you describe yourself as, you know, being Jewish, living in the prophetic tradition, and it was as if you were prophesying dark days ahead. Clearly you saw that in advance with Mr. Trump and Brexit, but actually to be able to ridicule again rather than worry quietly, I think is getting your power back, maybe.
Yes, well, I never thought I'd lost it. I just thought I was doing something else. Absolutely, in Pussy, there is no hiding from the possible darkness ahead. I mean, mankind is very, very good at getting itself out of a scrape, and I suspect it will get itself out of this scrape. But that doesn't mean one shouldn't feel full of doom at the same time. Maybe Jay particularly was a dark book, and I think I couldn't see a way to ridicule what seemed to me what was happening in the world, which was that a mere 50, 60 years after the Holocaust, anti-Semitism was back. I couldn't find a handle of ridicule on that, if you like. And that might be why I just needed to descend into the darkness more than I usually do.
People always talk about you as a Jewish writer. I see you very much, or equally, as an English writer. You have as much of a sense of place as you do of race. Do you think that actually carrying that duality within you is very important to make you into a reasonable human being as well as a good writer?
I think a duality is always good, and whatever the word is for having three parts and four parts and five parts is always good. It seems to me you have to be in an argument with yourself all the time. We are our best selves when we are in an argument with ourselves. We develop through that. We beat down the prejudices and the bigotries that we all have in ourselves, the limitations, if we hear another voice and attend another voice, and find ourselves absurd at our most serious and the opposite. So an argument, yes. And I see that argument that I have with myself as a Jewish thing, actually. Jews, we love dispute. Our Talmudic tradition goes back to arguing all the time, arguing the Torah. There's no text so holy in Judaism that we don't question it. So we question at all times, even the very, you know, the very most sacred tenets of our belief are always up for questioning. And I love that about being Jewish. But of course, I mean, I do think I'm lucky to be Jewish and English, because the English too are very vigorously self-questioning and self-ironic. And I like what you've just said about place and race. And I do think of myself as an English writer before I think of myself as a Jewish writer. I loved literature at school when I was growing up. I read literature as a little. I wasn't reading Jewish books particularly. I knew I was Jewish, but I didn't put literature and Jewishness together, though I did put Englishness and literature together. And it surprised me when I ended up writing about Jewish things, because I hadn't even realised I was interested in them. But it seemed that although I wanted to be Jane Austen, George Eliot, and Dickens, those were the ones I most loved and wanted to emulate. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't write at all, it appeared, until somehow or other I found a little bit of space for the Jewish question. It was only by acknowledging my Jewishness that I found a voice and understood what my voice was and the ways in which I wasn't like all the other English writers I admired. I knew I wasn't like the American Jewish writers, who I thought were terrific, but I thought, I'm not like that. And it took me a long time to realise that the reason I'm not like that was because I was English with English, different English, more savage thing. I got from the English a more savage comedy, really, which Americans sometimes find me hard to take, and they can't work it out because they think I should be like them because I'm Jewish and we make similar jokes and things. But in the end, the English quality bemuses them. And what bemused me as a young Englishman trying to write out of Cambridge and who'd done nothing but read books, really, was that my voice wasn't quite like that, and the Jewishness had to be found. That's a long way of agreeing with you.
Well, thank you. In English literature, the most awful things happen, but quite often there is a happy ending. And I suppose in a post-Holocaust world, you realise that there isn't always a happy ending, which I think forms that wonderful duality in your books, where the reader never quite knows what's going to happen in the next chapter.
I don't even know whether I believe in happy endings. I spend an awful lot of time wondering about my own ending, more and more now as I age. And although I've always, as a writer, been very careful not to give facile happy endings to my characters, I wouldn't mind a facile happy ending for myself. I can't see how it comes about, unless there is some blinding light towards the end of my life that suddenly explains what it's all been for. It looks only dark out there, I have to tell you. I'm writing a novel about all that at the minute, and it's quite tough because the material is gloomy, and my natural impulse, which is to not to find the lightness, but to find comedy at its most sardonic, because it's good to laugh, we always say. But actually, I think it's really good to laugh savagely and sourly and bitterly. It just seems to clear the system. How that's going to help me personally, as opposed to a writer, I don't know. I dread it, if you want to know. Between ourselves, I dread it. And I don't see where this blinding light that's going to say it's all right. The blinding light of meaning. That's it, really. What will give it meaning? What could make one feel at the end of one's life that the life you've lived has been not only worthwhile, because that's probably easy to do. You can look back on family and achievements and love and feel that was something. But more than that, just that more, the kind of thing that has made people of different faiths forever believe in another life. I think it's fantastically difficult not to believe everything in another life. Everything rational in me knows that there can't be, but that doesn't stop me wanting it.
You're a worrier, aren't you?
I'm Jewish.
Yes, I know. And Shylock is my name. Says worry is a way of keeping the world close and safe. It's beautiful to express it like that, but it's not good for the fingernails and it doesn't help you sleep at night.
No, but as long as you're writing, this is where it's useful to be a writer, as long as you're writing, it's okay. I loved creating, or if you like, recreating Shylock, because that idea that person is able to talk, he has no life. It was very important to me when I rewrote Shylock is My Name, which was a rewriting of the Merchant of Venice. It was very important to me not to tell another story. It was fantastic, really, to have a Shakespearean character. What a challenge to kind of enter a Shakespearean character for a long, long time throughout a novel and imagining him still worrying over everything that happened. And he has a lot to worry over. And that suits my style, actually, to just fret at it and worry at it and find the light in it and then descend back into the chaos and the darkness again and then claw your way out back into the light. That to me is, well, that's a story not just of writing a book, it's the story of being alive.
Shylock is My Name by Howard Jacobson. To avoid falling into the hands of the state was reason in itself for making money. One worked and earned in order not to die disgracefully. You take my life when you do take the means whereby I live, and the means whereby I hope to die as well. And then, of course, talking of dying, there was the money needed to escape in a hurry when the hour came. Scooping what was left of his family into his arms and never stopping to look back, Even the Jewishly on-again, off-again Strulevich was never Jewishly off-again when it came to believing this. Safety was not to be taken for granted. The danger hour always came around. In the meantime, knowing each morning that his wife would be washed, that his daughter would be educated, and that his money would be there when he needed it for bribing officials at borders, or just for carers of his own, left him free to pursue his interests. And pursuing his interests kept him from bewailing the ruins of his wife. There was a great deal to be said, Strulevich believed, for keeping busy. The other word for which, as Beatrice's teachers were surely telling her with relish, was capitalism. But he didn't revel in wealth. He revelled, in so far as he could be called a reveller at all, in the world he could see. "I already am spiritual," he would have said to anyone who tried to remind him of all that wasn't worldly. "I am spiritual to the degree that I think the material world is infused with the divine." And love? He didn't understand how anyone could love what wasn't visible. This didn't mean he didn't love his daughter when he didn't see her. But then when didn't he see her? Worry is a way of keeping an image close and safe, and from the moment of his wife's stroke, no further back than that, he had worried about his daughter constantly.
Thank you to Howard Jacobson, and a wide selection of his novels is available from the RNIB Library, including The Finkler Question, read by Stephen Crossley, which is TB17970, and we'll be hearing more from Howard Jacobson later in the show. Dorothy Parker was an American writer and poet renowned for her sharp wit. From the 1920s till her death in 1967, she used her acerbic sense of humour to satirise the vices, pretensions and hypocrisies she saw around her. Here, from her collected poems, is a taste of what she was capable of. It's read by Liza Ross.
Unfortunate coincidence. By the time you swear you're his, shivering and sighing, and he vows his passion is infinite, undying, lady, make a note of this. One of you is lying. Song of Perfect Propriety. Oh, I should like to ride the seas, a roaring buccaneer, a cutlass banging at my knees, a dirk behind my ear. And when my captive's chains would clank, I'd howl with glee and drink, and then fling out the quivering plank and watch the beggars sink. I'd like to straddle gory decks and dig in laden sands and know the feel of throbbing necks between my knotted hands. Oh, I should like to strut and curse among my blackguard crew, but I am writing little verse as little ladies do. Oh, I should like to dance and laugh and pose and preen and sway and rip the hearts of men in half and toss the bits away. I'd like to view the reeling years through unastonished eyes and dip my fingertips in tears and give my smiles for sighs. I'd stroll beyond the ancient bounds and tap at fastened gates and hear the prettiest of sounds, the clink of shattered fates. My slaves I'd like to bind with thongs that cut and burn and chill. But I am writing little songs, as little ladies will.
Her collected poems are available as TB22678.
This is Read On Air.
Someone I suspect Dorothy Parker would have thoroughly approved of is Paul Beattie. His book, The Sellout, won last year's Man Booker Prize. It's a wickedly funny social satire set in contemporary Los Angeles. Robert Kirkwood wanted to find out more.
At the zoo, I stood in front of the primate cage listening to a woman marvel at how presidential the 400-pound gorilla looked, sitting astride a shorn oaken limb, keeping a watchful eye over his caged brood. When her boyfriend, his finger tapping the informational placard, pointed out the presidential silverback's name coincidentally was Baraka, the woman laughed aloud until she saw me, the other 400-pound gorilla in the room, stuffing something that might have been the last of a big stick popsicle or a Chiquita banana in my mouth. Then she became disconsolate, crying and apologizing for having spoken her mind and my having been born. "Some of my best friends are monkeys," she said accidentally. It was my turn to laugh.
That was Prentice Onayemi reading from the Booker Prize-winning book, The Sellout, and Paul Beatty joined me on the line.
That's a quirky little book about a guy who's from a town that's disappeared off the map in Southern California, a little town outside of Los Angeles, and he decides to put the town back on a map, him and a weird ex-child star actor friend of his, and they decide to put the town on the map by reinstituting racial segregation.
Now, is it hard? It's a very funny book. Is it hard to be funny about that?
Nah. I don't know. I just write the way I write, and usually it comes out humorous at some level. It's just how I think about things and how I tend to put them down on the page. So, I mean, the writing part is hard. I mean, it's extremely hard, but I don't know, the jokes just come, you know, and whenever they come, that's when I put them in there.
Now, history has been made as you're the first American to win the Booker Prize. Was there a fear that it wouldn't translate to a British reading audience?
I mean, I think the book, for me, does feel really American, which is not something I think about the stuff that I write very often, but it does feel really American. But as far as I can tell, there's some resonation here, and so I think that's good. I mean, that's translating for some folks, for sure. So, and apparently with the Man Booker people, so I'm deeply thankful for that.
Now, one thing we don't get as a blind or partially sighted reader is the cover. How does the cover reflect the book?
That's an interesting question. So the cover is something called a lawn jockey, which is like out of this old tradition of like during slavery and like immediately after slavery, like race jockeys in America were usually black men. And so people started having these little lawn jockeys in front of their houses. And at some time, I guess probably in the 50s, 60s, 70s, those things just became kind of racist iconography.
Mm.
And so now you still see them, but they're never black, or very, very rarely they'll be white. You know, it's just like a guy in a racing kit holding a lantern. They'll be about like maybe 2 to 3 feet high. And they're just some kind of weird thing. And at some level, it just, if you had one of those outside of your house, it just said something about your cultural attitudes, I guess. So they're out of fashion.
I understood where she was coming from. This whole city's a Freudian slip of the tongue. A concrete hard-on for America's deeds and misdeeds. Slavery? Manifest Destiny? Laverne and Shirley? Standing by idly while Germany tried to kill every Jew in Europe? Why, some of my best friends are the Museum of African Art, the Holocaust Museum, the Museum of the American Indian, the National Museum of Women and the Arts, and furthermore, I'll have you know my sister's daughter is married to an orangutan.
Another clip of The Sellout, read there by Prentice Onayemi. And you haven't heard the audio version, so you don't know how the book translates into audio.
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I think I think there's an audio version in the States, which I just haven't listened to because, you know, the book sounds a certain way in my head. I just kind of don't want to hear it sound differently or even have it sound better than it does in my head. That would be hard to cope with. I don't know. What's funny is, like, there's a lot of weird bits in the book. Like, there's a map in the book and some charts and some little kind of things. So I'm wondering how they do that in terms of audio. Like, if they just skip that or if they try to... I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, if I think about it, I'm sure a lot of the topics and themes covered in the book are familiar to British readers, you know, whether they're very American or not, you know. I don't think that it's stuff that just is completely unrelatable. I'd be surprised.
Now, where were you when you heard the news that you were on the shortlist?
That's a good question. I was probably at home. I think sifting through my emails, I think that's how I found out my publisher told me.
And we've heard from publishers, certainly here, that it goes a bit crazy when you're nominated. Was it the same over there?
I think so. I mean, it's a fairly small house. But I feel like apparently they've been through the process already, so they were not prepared for it, but I think they were able to deal with it. But, you know, they seem excited, and they're pleased, I'm pleased. It's a good problem to have, I think.
Another nice problem, I suppose, coming up is that you'll have lots of live events. How comfortable are you reading it in public?
I'm okay. I don't like reading particularly, but I'm okay. I get through it, and I usually... try to. I usually end up reading really fast and trying to get it over with. But usually it's fine.
Because the amount of jokes in it and the delivery in some of it does. It would lend itself to a stand-up show, and stand-up comedy does come into the novel at some point as well.
You know, it's funny now that you think about that. I don't talk about this very often, but I think this is a guess. I'm not sure, but I think a large part depends on, for me, what I've noticed. It depends on who's in the audience, and there's a lot of sensitive or things that people find sensitive in the book. Some of the jokes, and I think. There can be some feelings of guilt when you're in public. Like, I think sometimes people are a little afraid to laugh at certain parts, or like waiting for me to laugh to give them permission that it's okay to laugh. And so that part can be a little strange, I think.
So the color of the audience would affect the
I think it's color. I don't think it's just color. I think it's also, for me, I've found geographically it depended where I was, what happened in the news the day before. You know, the generation of the audience, older, younger, but it's just different.
And finally, did you start writing this before the current rise of Donald Trump?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it took me almost 5 years to write this book. And the book's been done for probably close to 3 years, I bet. And
yet it's perhaps more appropriate given the current political situation
now. From my perspective, it's not more appropriate. It was appropriate then, it's appropriate now, and, I think odds are it's going to be appropriate tomorrow, unfortunately.
All it takes is a day trip through Georgetown and Chinatown, a slow saunter past the White House, Phoenix House, Blair House, and the local crack house for the message to become abundantly clear. Be it ancient Rome or modern-day America, you're either citizen or slave, lion or Jew, guilty or innocent, comfortable or uncomfortable. And here in the Supreme Court of the United States of America, if between the handcuffs and the slipperiness of this chair's leather upholstery, the only way I can keep from spilling my ass ignominiously onto the goddamn floor is to lean back until I'm reclined at an angle just short of detention room nonchalance, but definitely well past courtroom contempt.
Paul, thanks so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks for having me.
My thanks to Robert and to Paul Beattie. The Sellout is available from the RNIB Library, where each year, thanks to a long-standing agreement between the Man Booker Prize and the RNIB, all the shortlisted titles are available in Braille, large print, and on audio, so that we, alongside the judges, can ponder who the winner should be.
This is an RNIB talking book. Since both Switzerland's national products, snow and chocolate, melt, the cuckoo clock was invented solely in order to give tourists something solid to remember it by.
Chocolate and cuckoo clocks, the essential, Alan Corrin.
I imagine that's the dining room, I said.
That's what you want to do, Squire, he said. Imagine.
Edited and introduced by his children, Giles and Victoria Corrin, Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks is an anthology of writing from the former editor of Punch, Alan Corrin.
Now is the time of year to stop writing gardening advice articles and move into a tower block.
Read by Peter Noble and featuring contributions by Victoria Wood, Melvin Bragg, Giles Corrin and Victoria Corrin Mitchell.
So who's going to write the introduction?
I thought we were doing it together.
I don't know. I've never written with anyone else. He never wrote with anyone else.
It's not that hard. One person types, the other one paces.
Every day at 2 with a repeat at 10. Or you can catch up with the whole book online at the RNIB Connect radio website.
This is Read On Air.
The death of Colin Dexter was announced earlier this week. Best known as the creator of Inspector Morse, he was also famously generous with his time and advice. I was fortunate enough to meet him in the mid-1990s when I was working as a very junior journalist. After finishing my very brief interview with him, I plucked up courage and confessed that I too hoped to become a crime writer. Rather than dismissing my foolishness, he took the time to give me a few tips and told me that when I had a manuscript that I was happy with, I should send it to him and he'd look it over. 14 years later, I did just that, and he was as good as his word. Without his encouragement, I doubt my book would ever have seen the light of day. Read On Air will be broadcasting a crime special in a few weeks' time, in which Morse and Lewis are due to feature. But in the meantime, we'd like to bid Colin Dexter farewell with a clip from his final novel, The Remorseful Day.
Hardy's yokels usually knew all about the goings-on in the Wessex villages, and their role is paralleled today by the likes of the Alfs and the Berts in the Cotswold public houses. Although I now know who murdered Yvonne Harrison, it will not be easy to prove the guilt of the accused party. I am reminded of the Greek philosopher Protagoras, who found it difficult to be dogmatic about the existence of the gods, partly because of the obscurity of the subject matter, and partly because of the brevity of human life. But herewith I give my final thoughts on the murder of Yvonne Harrison, that crisply uniformed nurse who looked after me in hospital once, but once, with such tempting, loving care. He finished writing an hour later at 12:45 a.m. Or, perhaps, to be accurate, he wrote no more thereafter.
Nuala Salter is one of the dedicated team of RNIB librarians who work so tirelessly to guide us to the books that we want to read. This month, they've all been mugging up on modern classics. Nuala's choice was Aldous Huxley's dark dystopian satire, Brave New World, and she kindly gave Read On Air a sneak preview of her thoughts about it.
So it's based in a world in the future where human beings are kind of grown in a factory, basically. Everybody's conditioned. They have different classes. They have alphas, betas, deltas. Nobody's a mother. And they have this whole concept of everyone belongs to everyone. And they're conditioned to sort of not enjoy reading or art or nature. So they're there to just to be functional, really. So the main character is Bernard, who's at the top level. He's an alpha plus, but something goes wrong when he's an embryo and his growth is kind of slightly stunted. And then there's Lenina. Nobody has a relationship with anyone. Everybody belongs to everyone is the phrase that they use. It's considered immoral if you're seeing the same person for more than a few weeks. So Lenina and Bernard go off to this savage reservation and it's completely opposite to the way that they live. So it's a complete primitive existence. There's no mod cons, no technology. And they meet a woman who used to be part of their world who's got pregnant, which is considered absolutely disgusting in their world. And she's got a son called John who is obviously now a man. So they think it'd be a great idea to bring them back to their world. And Bernard becomes a bit of a celebrity because he brings this savage back to this so-called utopia. It kind of portrays these two completely different worlds. You know, you've got this one where everybody has what they want and they can have whoever they want. And you've got this other extreme world where it's the complete opposite. I found it really, really compelling to read. But there were elements in the book that actually left me feeling quite cold. I'm kind of not quite sure whether the book was resolved for me at the end, but I don't know whether that's what the author intended, because I think it was just a portrayal of these two extreme existences in a future world. But the interesting thing about the book was the things that he describes in the book, like the production of human beings in a laboratory, was kind of almost like, you know, IVF now, you've got genetic engineering and things like that now. So it was almost like seeing into the future, but a really extreme form of the modern world in a way. When I was reading it, there were elements that were kind of reflected modern society, which is quite interesting, really. Reading it as a classic, but actually seeing how his projection into the future, the way he described a future society, some of it has become a reality. You know, some of the technologies it describes and things like that, is quite fascinating. I also found the book a bit chilling and unresolved for me at the end. I think it's probably meant to leave you feeling, well, actually, how does it, do they just carry on as they are or what? But I would recommend it as a classic, particularly for anyone who likes science fiction fantasy. But it was a fascinating read.
Mother, monogamy, romance. High spurts, the fountain. Fierce and foamy the wild jet, the urge has but a single outlet. My love, my baby. No wonder those poor pre-moderns were mad and wicked and miserable. Their world didn't allow them to take things easily, didn't allow them to be sane, virtuous, happy. What with mothers and lovers, what with the prohibitions they were not conditioned to obey. What with the temptations and the lowly remorses, what with all the diseases and the endless isolating pain, what with the uncertainties and the poverty, they were forced to feel strongly. And feeling strongly, and strongly, what was more, in solitude, in hopeless individual isolation, how could they be stable?
Thank you, Nuala. Brave New World is available in a range of accessible formats, including as TB21699. The hope of any satirical writer is to change lives, and as actor and talking book narrator Steve Hodson reveals, this can happen.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for R&IB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine in 35 years I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. But one I do remember is a book called Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's a surreal and fantastical book about Satan paying a visit to Moscow. And it's full of weird and wacky creatures, and Satan's entourage of little devils. And it is absolutely bizarre.
Allow me to introduce you. Roland began, then interrupted himself. No, really. He looks too ridiculous. Just look what he has done to himself while he was under the bed. The cat, covered in dust and standing on its hind legs, bowed to Margarita. Round its neck, it was now wearing a made-up white bow tie on an elastic band, with a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl binoculars hanging on a cord. It had also gilded its whiskers. "What have you done?" exclaimed Roland. "Why have you gilded your whiskers? And what on earth do you want with a white tie when you haven't even got any trousers?"
"Trousers don't suit cats, Messiah," replied the cat with great dignity.
"Sit down and stop all this hot air."
"Very well," replied the cat, sitting down. "But I must object. My remarks are by no means all hot air, as you so vulgarly put it, but a series of highly apposite syllogisms, which would be appreciated by such connoisseurs as Sextus Empiricus, Martian Capella, even, who knows, Aristotle himself."
"Check," said Roland.
"Check it is," rejoined the cat, surveying the chessboard through his lorgnette.
"So," Roland turned to Margarita, "let me introduce my retinue. That creature who has been playing the fool is the cat Behemoth. Azazielo and Kuroviev you have already met. This is my maid, Hela. She is prompt, clever, and there's no service she cannot perform for you. A charming and select little band."
It is a thinly veiled critique of Stalinist Russia. No wonder Stalin didn't like Mikhail Bulgakov. I love this writer anyway. I've done a couple of his plays because he also worked at Moscow Arts Theatre. And I like his work a lot. But it stands out in my mind because not long ago I was phoned with the help of the BBC. A young man got in touch with me and said he and his girlfriend were listening to Master and Margarita together and that they both loved it. But it was going to be her birthday the following week. And he was taking her down to Dorset, and at a certain time on her birthday, they were going to be walking along a beach there. And he asked me to phone him at that time. He would hand his phone to his girlfriend, and he wanted me to sing Happy Birthday in the voice I'd used for Satan in The Master and Margarita, which I did. I wish you could have heard her giggles. It was a lot of fun. Apparently they went out and had a very good lunch and far too much red wine afterwards. But it's lovely to be invited to do things like that. just because you've recorded a book. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks to Steve. His reading of The Master and Margarita is TB11812, and long may it continue bringing joy to the lives of others. For years now, my brother-in-law Andy has been telling me that I should get into Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. So, when I was looking for something satirical to read for the show, I thought, well, why not? But with nearly 50 titles to choose from, where to start? So I rang Andy and asked for a recommendation.
I don't think a programme about satire would be complete without the inclusion of at least one of Terry Pratchett's many Discworld novels. Superficially, they are light-hearted fantasy stories about witches and wizards living on a flat world carried through space on the back of an immense turtle. However, as well as having a great imagination and a lovely turn of phrase, Pratchett was a particularly keen observer of people and society. Consequently, it's not at all hard to detect the sharp satire that lurks behind the veneer of swords and sorcery. His books are easy to read and often very funny, and they have a depth that rewards a little reflection, even rereading. Going Postal is a particular favourite of mine, and although it was one of his later novels, there's no need to have read the previous ones because it's a standalone story. It revolves around the appointment of a habitual con man, the wonderfully named Moist von Litwig, to run a moribund postal system. This affords Pratchett plenty of opportunity to poke fun at corporate greed and extol the merits of public service, whilst amusing the reader with golems, banshees, and the perils of having a daughter with a strong sense of moral purpose. A great book by a wonderful author.
The story starts with the hanging of Moist von Litwig, a con artist whose crimes catch up with him in the city of Ankh-Morpork. But the con man has been conned. His execution was faked by order of the city's ruler, who offers him a choice. Take over the running of Ankh-Morpork's decrepit postal service, or die. After trying to run away and hide, Moist reluctantly sets to work.
Moist von Litwig raised his eyes and examined his future. The Ankh-Morpork Central Post Office had a gaunt frontage. It was a building designed for a purpose. It was, therefore, more or less, a big box to employ people in, with two wings at the rear which enclosed the big stable yard. Some cheap pillars had been sliced in half and stuck on the outside. Some niches had been carved for some miscellaneous stone nymphs. Some stone urns had been ranged along the parapet, and thus architecture had been created. In appreciation of the thought that had gone into this, the good citizens, or more probably their kids, had covered the walls to a height of 6 feet with graffiti in many exciting colours. In a band, all along the top of the frontage, staining the stone in greens and browns, some words had been set in letters of bronze. Neither rain, nor snow, nor glom of nit can stay these messengers abot their duty, Moist read aloud. What the hell does that mean? The post office was once a proud institution, said Mr. Pump. And that stuff, Moist pointed. On a board much further down the building, in peeling paint, with the less heroic words, don't ask us about rocks, trolls with sticks, all sorts of dragons, Mrs. Cake, huge green things with teeth, any kinds of black dogs with orange eyebrows, reins of spaniels, fog, Mrs. Cake. I said it was a proud institution. Who's Mrs. Cake?
The post office is stuffed with 50 years of undelivered mail and staffed only by a crusty old man, an obsessive boy, and a grumpy cat. But his problems don't stop there. Soon he finds himself contending with the Postal Workers' Friendly and Benevolent Society, the evil chairman of the Grand Trunk Company, who runs a rival semaphore service, and a killer in the night who may or may not have murdered four of Moist's predecessors. Oh, and just to complicate matters, he falls in love too. Falling back on what he knows, Moist realises that his only hope lies in forging the illusion that people want to see. It works, and soon he's being hailed as a guru.
Moist von Litwig saw the writing on the wall, or at least hanging in the air just in front of it. The hidden pen swooped through the air in loops and curves, drawing its glowing blue letters behind it. "Moist von Lipwig," it wrote. Yes? "You are the postmaster." "Look, I'm not the one you're looking for. Moist von Lipwig, at a time like this, anyone will do." But I'm not worthy." "Acquire worth with speed, Moist von Lipwig. Bring back the light. Open the doors. Stay not the messengers about their business." Moist looked down at the golden light coming up from around his feet. It sparkled off his fingertips and began to fill him up from inside like fine wine. He felt his feet leave the dais as the words lifted him up and spun him gently. "In the beginning was a word, but what is a word without its messenger, Moist von Lipwig? You are the postmaster." "I am the postmaster," Moist shouted. "The mail must move, Moist von Lipwig. Too long have we been bound here." "I will move the mail." "You will move the mail." "I will. I will." "Moist von Lipwig." "Yes." The words came like a gale, whirling the envelopes in the sparkling light, shaking the building to its foundations. "Deliver us."
As the book's blurb asks, is there a shot at redemption waiting in the mad world of the mail for a man who's prepared to push the envelope? The story is packed with puns and wordplay, and it was a joy to read. It's also very clever, but not in a way that excludes readers who are new to Discworld. I'd been worried that I might miss out on a lot of the backstory if I didn't read the series in sequence, but Andy's recommendation was spot on. Going postal requires no previous knowledge. Another concern I'd had is that I usually find it difficult to suspend my disbelief and enter into fantasy worlds of wizards and elves. But here again, Pratchett's infectious humour and his eye for quirky human behaviour and his amazing ear for dialogue made the inhabitants of Ankh-Morpork appear no more weird than those of London or any capital city. And as I chuckled along with Stephen Briggs's brilliant reading, I realised just how clever a creation Discworld is. It's a distorting mirror held up to our own society that turns some into dwarves and others into golems. It allows Pratchett to poke fun at our foibles and ridicule our prejudices. In Going Postal, he satirises not just the post office, but hackers, human rights activists, tradesmen's guilds, religions, hospitals, PR gurus, and telecoms companies. But he saves his vitriol for corporate raiders in the form of his villain Reacher Guilt and the culture that enables him to flourish.
Like an apprentice staring at the work of a master, he read Reacher Guilt's words on the still damp newspaper. It was garbage, but it had been cooked by an expert. Oh, yes. You had to admire the way perfectly innocent words were mugged, ravished, stripped of all true meaning and decency, and then sent to walk the gutter for Reacher Guilt, although synergistically had probably been a whore from the start. The Grand Trunk's problems were clearly the result of some mysterious spasm in the universe and had nothing to do with greed, arrogance, and willful stupidity. Oh, the Grand Trunk management had made mistakes. Oops. Well-intentioned judgments which, with the benefit of hindsight, might regrettably have been, in some respects, in error. But these had mostly occurred, it appeared, while correcting fundamental systemic errors committed by the previous management. No one was sorry for anything because no living creature had done anything wrong. Bad things had happened by spontaneous generation in some weird, chilly, geometrical otherworld and were to be regretted. Another bastard phrase that had sell itself to any weasel in a tight corner. The Times reporter had made an effort, but nothing short of a stampede could have stopped Reacher Guilt in his crazed assault on the meaning of meaning. The Grand Trunk was about people, and the reporter had completely failed to ask what that meant exactly. And then there was this piece called Our Mission. Moist felt the acid rise in his throat until he could spit lacework in a sheet of steel. Meaningless, stupid words from people without wisdom or intelligence or any skill beyond the ability to water the currency of expression.
It's all remarkably prescient, considering that Going Postal was published in 2004, a full 4 years before the financial crisis. But even when he's angry, and a sense of outrage lies at the heart of all good satire, Terry Pratchett never allows it to dominate his writing. One risk run by satirists is their tendency to revel in their ability to ridicule others. This can turn their humour sour and make them boring. But Pratchett has the rare gift of writing sympathetic satire. He revels in silliness and the ridiculous things people do to get what they want. When this results in posturing, he delights in poking fun at them and thereby us. When it hurts others, he applies an edge to his wit that makes it razor sharp and very compelling. In his acceptance speech for the Carnegie Medal in 2001, Terry Pratchett said, "Fantasy isn't just about wizards and silly wands. It's about seeing the world from new directions." Andy's Educating Red recommendation has finally opened my eyes to the fantastic view of our world that you get from Discworld, and I can't wait to return there for more. Going Postal is available from the RNIB Library as TB14127, where you'll also find stacks of other Discworld novels in various accessible formats. Now, as promised, we return to Howard Jacobson to share the books of his life. So, Howard, was there a book that inspired you as a young man to become a writer?
Without doubt, the book that had the most influence on me as a boy and maybe turned me into a writer was Palgrave's Golden Treasury of English Verse. My mother read it, and we read it together. And I can still see now the poems that I read from those volumes with my mother. Wordsworth, Lucy poems, that Emily Bronte poem, Cold in the Earth with the Deep Snow Piled Above Thee. Have I Forgot My Only Love to Love This? I've not even got that right. The Wordsworth poem, which I think about and write about almost every week, surprised by joy, impatient as the wind, I turn to share the transport, oh, with whom but thee, deep buried in the silent tomb. That moment, that wonderful moment of forgetting that somebody you love deeply is not with you because they've died, and then that terrible sense of guilt that you've not remembered that they have died. And yet what greater memory of a person can you have than to think that they're with you all the time? You can see I was a morbid boy. My mum liked morbid poems, and we read these things. Although I don't come from an educated household, my dad didn't read books at all. My mother didn't read what I would call high literature. She read novels by people like Neville Shute and Nigel Balkin, novelists of that period, maybe even Graham Greene. I think she slid me into Graham Greene in my early teen years. But it was those poems that we read when I was quite small, I think. The love, you see, that I still have for the sound of language before narrative. Let's hear the sounds of it all. So that really is my poetry, was my childhood book.
And what would you choose for your rainy day title?
I loved Great Expectations. It's the only one of Dickens' stories, and maybe it's the only one of anybody's stories, where all the convolutions of plot mean something. It's not just about coincidence. It means something that the money passed along this route. It means something that the dream that Pip has to clean himself of all vulgar criminal associations is impossible because we're all mired in something. I mean, it is a fantastically moral plot. And I kind of got that quite soon, really, and I loved all that. And it was a novel that made me laugh. I can still see that very early, that Christmas table where Pip is sitting there, hemmed in by all those appalling family members, Uncle Pumblechook, who are making him, one of them makes him do mental arithmetic. Another one talks about them, be grateful boy to those who brought you up by hand. Meanwhile, poor innocent Joe is spooning Pip more gravy from the gravy dish. Joe gave me some more gravy. Wonderfully orchestrated opera of what it's like being. I might have been a little bull in arena. I was so goaded by there. That lovely picture of everybody's conversation, you know, pricking him like a bull. People do that novel a great disservice by calling it a snob's progress, as though all Pip wants to do is, you know, turn his back on those he's loved and make himself a gentleman. Because the book is told with such understanding of that and such sympathy for it that you just feel, well, that's everybody's story. Of course we want to. Of course, if we're born in that marshland, in that dark and cold, we want to go somewhere else. And of course we want that. So Pip remains sympathetic, even at his least sympathetic. And the idealization of Estella is one of the great tales, not just because it's a narrative, but because it's so true about a certain kind of male idealization of a woman. She at least is free of criminality. She at least is pure and spotless. Estella, icy, cold. She isn't. She's the daughter. She turns out to be the daughter of the criminal. It's fantastic. Mm. That is just fantastic. It's a very, very interesting novel about sex and embarrassing sex and violence and things. And I love in that novel the fact that Mrs. Joe, who gets beaten to within a sense of her life, it's so upsetting, cringes. She regains a degree of consciousness, and she cringes when she sees the man who did it. It's so terrifying, and almost becomes subservient to him. It's a disturbing book.
Have you read anything recently that you'd like to recommend to the listeners?
It's a novel called Carew, K-A-R-O-O. It's by Steve Tessish. He is not now alive. He died quite young. When you read this novel, you'll know why he died, because you can't write a novel of such bitter black comedy and live. Born in Yugoslavia, went to America when he was about 14, became a filmmaker, won an Oscar for something, can't remember what, wrote plays, won awards for plays, wrote two novels, and then wrote this, which is the story of somebody who doctors scripts for Hollywood. If they feel a script isn't working, or if they feel it's too nice, he makes it horrible. That's what he does. And he's in a world of total, utter cynicism. To call it corrupt doesn't do justice to it. The story of a disintegration, a total and complete disintegration, which he manages to make in the blackest possible way funny. So you read it, you laugh, your heart stops, you need to hold on to something while you're reading it. That's been the book that's inspired me over the last few years. I don't know what I can learn from it, because I don't think I want to go into anywhere. I'm black enough, thank you. I don't think I want to go anywhere as dark as that. But for your listeners who have a taste for the really black-hearted comedy, Carew.
Howard Jacobson, thank you very much for giving us a fantastic reading list, and thank you for sharing your love of reading and writing with the Read On Air listeners.
It's my pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of talking to you.
My thanks again to Howard Jacobson, and if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Howard, Nuala, Andy and Paul, and all of you who've been in touch about your book groups, what you're reading, and your suggestions for titles that I should read. Next week, we'll be discussing historical non-fiction. Thanks for listening, and remember to read on.